the subject, "The great day of his wrath shall come. Who is able to stand?" And the reading, Revelation chapter 6.
Brothers and sisters and young people, we welcome you here to our Revelation class tonight, and tonight we'll be considering chapter 6. To open our meeting then, we'll sing hymn number 140, which will be followed by prayer. Hymn number 140. And the sixth seal, the great day of his wrath shall come. Who shall be able to stand? And to introduce our study, I'll call upon Brother Peter Halpin to read for us Revelation chapter 6.
Reading together from the book of Revelation at chapter 6. And I saw, when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder, one of the four beasts saying, "Come and see." And I saw, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. And when he had opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, "Come and see." And there went out another horse that was red, and power was given unto him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they might, and that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. And when he had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast say, "Come and see." And I beheld, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, "A measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny, and see thou hurt not the oil and the wine." And when he had opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth beast say, "Come and see." And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death, and Hell followed with him. And power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth, to kill with sword, and with hunger, and with death, and with the beast of the earth. And when he had opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God, and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy, just, and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? And white robes were given unto every one of them, and it was said unto them that they should rest yet for a little season, until their fellow servants also, and their brethren that should be killed as they were, should be fulfilled. And I beheld when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood, and the stars of heaven fell unto the earth, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs, when she is shaken of a mighty wind. And the heaven departed as a scroll, when it is rolled together. And every mountain and island was moved out of their places. And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman and every free man hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, Fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sitteth upon the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand?
The fifth and the sixth seal. The great day of his wrath shall come, who shall be able to stand? Brother John Knowles.
Dear brethren and sisters and dear young people, this brings us to our last study for the year in the book of Revelation, and it also brings us to the end of this second section of the book, which concludes at the end of Revelation chapter 6. So this evening we hope to bring this section of our study to a climax with what I trust will be some very personal and some very powerful exhortation for each one of us. You'll be pleased to know there are no questionnaires and no quizzes this evening. I won't ask if anyone's read the notes. I saw quite a few of you doing it before the meeting tonight, so that's better than nothing. I think it's a good idea to be reading notes before the meeting, because at least does give us a chance to settle down and concentrate our thoughts on the things before us. So that's all we've got to say on the matter of policy for this evening. We'll go straight on with the study. Now, I promised you last time that I would briefly review the first four seals, that you might compare what exhortations you got out of it with what I think are some of the exhortations which come to us, and then we'll look, God willing, at the final two seals, the fifth and the sixth, that is the final two seals as far as this chapter is concerned, and look at those in somewhat more of detail. Might pay you at this stage to have your notes generally open so that you can scan through some of the details there. Whilst I won't be referring to them in detail, you might just like to note some of the points, particularly in the sections dealing with the historical background. I know people generally think that history is a boring subject, but I hope that we're going to see in our study of Revelation that when it's seen from the divine viewpoint, and when we see God's view of history, then it becomes much more meaningful, and in fact it takes on a slightly different slant from what you read in textbooks. Textbooks take a particular approach to history, but the book of Revelation shows you what are really the important events, and sometimes they are events which the world doesn't think is all that important. Anyway, what we've got here in these first four seals is the state of affairs which existed in the Roman Empire just after the time that John was writing. So we've got to try and see in block a period of time going from about AD 100 through to about AD 300. I think we can assume that most people don't know much about that period. If they do know or did know a little bit about it, they probably studied it a few years ago and they've pretty well forgotten it. So I think we've got to be fair and assume that most people don't know much about that period. Well, it's a period of Roman history. That's the first thing we've got to say. Roman history, because it was the Roman Empire which was governing the world at that time. And here in Revelation chapter 6, God is looking down on that Roman world, and he's setting out before us the events which would happen, because he's writing them before they happened, and pointing out to us what would be the significant features of that period of history, AD 100 to AD 300, as far as the truth is concerned. Now, whilst the truth may not be specifically mentioned in all of these verses, There is nevertheless some implication as far as the truth is concerned. The first seal showed us a period of peace. A period of peace in which the arrowless bowman went forth conquering that he might conquer. Now what's the exhortation here? Well, the first and the obvious exhortation surely is that Yahweh provides the circumstances and will bless the work if we continue to proclaim it. So from the time of John, there was given the opportunity to the brethren of Christ to proclaim the truth. They are represented here as an arrowless bowman. It was a man who was going forth to fight, but he wasn't fighting with carnal weapons, he was fighting with the truth. He was proclaiming the truth and he was spreading the truth. And because he was doing this, Yahweh therefore provided an opportunity and circumstances for him to continue in that. You might like to contrast this with the situation we've got in Revelation chapter 11, which naturally we'll look at in more detail when we come to it. But in Revelation chapter 11, in a chapter which is dealing with the two witnesses, the two classes in European society which were opposing Rome, they weren't necessarily proclaiming the truth, but they were witnessing against error. In Revelation chapter 11 and verse 7 it says, "And when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them, and shall overcome them and kill them." Now the witnesses down through the ages have constituted quite a few of these so-called minority groups, like the Donatists and the Novatians and the Huguenots and people like that. And whilst they may not all have believed the truth in its purity, they have stood up against Rome. But in this particular period that Revelation 11 is dealing with, around about 1500, the opposition of the witnesses, both by word and by sword, because some did take up the sword, being the political type of Protestants, it had started to decline. And, the work which they had been doing in protecting the true ecclesia was removed. This protective influence was removed because the ecclesia at this time was ceasing to be as active in gospel proclamation as it had been previously. And so the papacy was allowed once again to gain the ascendancy and initiated another period of terrible persecution. Now, the long and short of that story is simply this, that whilst the true ecclesia was proclaiming the truth vigorously and fearlessly, Yahweh provided circumstances to allow it to continue this work. And the provision in the case of Revelation 11 was these witnesses, these Protestants, who stood up and they opposed Rome, and they allowed the true ecclesia a certain freedom of movement. Now, I think we've got a certain parallel in the first seal, in which Yahweh providentially provided peace in the empire for as long as these people were prepared to proclaim the truth fearlessly and in purity. In time, this lapsed. It lapsed principally on the basis that the truth started to become a bit corrupt. But it's also significant to note that as that declined, as the proclaiming of the truth declined, so the period of peace disappeared, and Yahweh brought in a time of great trouble on the empire. What conclusion can we draw out of this? Can we make a blanket statement that if we are prepared to at all times proclaim the truth, Yahweh will guard us against persecution? No, I don't think we can make a blanket statement quite like that. But we can say that there are many examples down through the ages where when people are prepared to make a stand for the truth, Yahweh will provide for them the circumstances which will assist them in their work, whatever those circumstances may be. And I think this is the lesson that we want to take to ourselves today. We, above all generations, have had an opportunity second to none to proclaim the truth. And we can talk about merely in this city if it comes to that. How is the situation going to continue? If we decline, if we slack off in our promulgation of the truth, and I don't just mean in the preaching work, but in the whole aspect of apocalypse, in the whole aspect of manifestation of the truth, it's not just a matter of saying, if we put on a few more public lectures, we're standing up for the truth a bit more. No, it's the whole overall purpose of God manifestation. If we're prepared to stand up for the truth and manifest the truth, then Yahweh will provide circumstances which will assist us to that end. It won't necessarily guard us from persecution, but it will allow an environment whereby his truth can go forward. When we stop proclaiming it, then Yahweh in many cases has seen fit to change the whole ambit of society. We are too close, of course, to our present time to be able to say categorically how we fit into this. It's too difficult to stand off and say, yes, the changes in the society in Australia or in South Australia have been as a result of certain things that we have or haven't done in the truth. One thing we can say for sure, and that is that society in South Australia has changed markedly in the last 10 years. I don't think that you could find any other city on the face of the earth at this present time which would have seen such a marked change in standards as the city of Adelaide has. I don't think we could find that. It has been a considerable swing, hasn't it, from the most conservative of conservatives now to the most liberal of liberals. And despite the fact that it's a Labor government, of course, but using the term in its broadest sense. And one stands back and says, well, you know, how does this affect the truth? How has the truth affected that? Well, I suppose the tendency may be that we might become a little reticent to speak out as much. Religion isn't as popular as it was back in the days of Thomas Playford, who was quite a religious person, and the government was basically religious. We had a marvellous opportunity to spread the truth, and I feel that brethren in the previous generation have done just that. How are we going to go as circumstances now change? Well, all of these things seem to come out of this first seal. You might feel that we've got a long, long way away from the point that it says there in Revelation 6, but I don't think so. I think we've got to look at a situation and then just let our minds extend and expand the idea into the various ramifications. The first seal dealt with God providing an opportunity for the preaching of the truth by the arrowless bowman. He did the work. When he ceased to do it, circumstances in the empire changed. We come on 1500 years later, and whilst the ecclesia is proclaiming the truth, Yahweh protects it through the various Protestant movements, both religious and political. What do we find today? A marvellous opportunity to proclaim the truth. Let us therefore take every opportunity we've got to maintain that standard. We seem to be emphasising gospel proclamation. Let's not just emphasise that. Let's realise it also involves the time and the application to study the word that we can manifest these things in our daily life. So that times of peace provide a first-class opportunity to spread the truth. Unfortunately, times of peace also sometimes provide more opportunity for spending time on self. And that's the challenging issue. What are we spending our time on today? We've got a better opportunity than ever before. Are we spending more time in proclaiming the truth and in building ourselves up in the truth? That's a question we've got to answer. Can we say yes? We are now more dedicated than we were 10 years ago because we are now in a more affluent society, or are we less dedicated? Well, I can't make a blanket statement and say we're less dedicated or we're more dedicated. I think I could safely say that we're not more dedicated, and that's not a nice thing to be able to say, but that's my feeling. I don't know what your feeling is, but I think we would like to see ourselves getting down to this word much more and really manifesting the principles of the truth in our speech, in our action, and of course in our proclamation. And so let's try and see ourselves in this environment and see what the lessons are for us. Well, we come onto the second seal, and we find now, as we've alluded to in the first one, that peace was taken away from the earth. Pagan Rome was going to fall. And this second seal, which deals with the red horse, and power was given to him that sat thereon to take the peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another, and there was given unto him a great sword. I don't think it would be fair to say that we are now on the eve of a period of the red horse. It could be true. I'm not trying to draw direct parallels with the six seals in that sense. But what I'm trying to say is that every period of history has its exhortation. The environment will be different, the situation will be different, but there's got to be an exhortation. Now, in this particular seal, there is nothing specifically said about the saints. This red horse speaks of the Roman Empire, and it speaks about the peace being taken from the empire. There is nothing in this verse to tell us how the saints fared. But let's try and recreate a picture. You've got a time of peace, and then you see the peace taken away. How do you react to that? We've had a time of peace. Who knows what's going to happen in the next few weeks or months in this particular country? there is every sign that there could be another red horse appearing. There is every sign of it. We still, and I think Christadelphians are just like the rest of Australians, we still keep saying it won't happen here. The fact that three letter bombs happened to have got posted last week, well, that was only three letter bombs. Well, you've got to start off with small numbers. You can't start off with big numbers. And we still say, oh, yes, but that was just a flash in the pan. One particular political party says, don't let your anger die. And you know, people are meant to take that seriously. And another political party says something just as bad, because we've got to realise that no one party is any better than the other in the sight of God. The fact is, the peace could well be taken away from our little earth here. Now, how would that have affected the saints in the first century? Doubtless many of them would have been so used to the time of peace that they couldn't appreciate that pagan Rome was about to fall. How many of them were going to see their hopes fall with it? Now look, let's be very, very scrutinising in our thinking here. Who can honestly say, honestly and genuinely say, that they haven't got a particular bias towards which party gets in on December the 13th, I think the date is, when the election is going to be? I think over the last few years I've seen a tendency in Christadelphia to not necessarily say anything positive about favouring certain parties, but certainly negative things. And David, I think, was very much to the point on Sunday when he commented on this. I think we ought to think about it. I think I've heard statements made about such and such a party's politics, thereby implying that perhaps another one is better. Look, they are all rotten to the core, every single one of them. They are all the epitome of the carnal mind. It might be that one or other seems to suit us because of our job, because of our, let's call it, social strata. I don't like using that word, but some of us may see ourselves as workers, a so-called blue collar. Others may see ourselves as the so-called white collar. Others as executives, others as pensioners, others as all sorts of things. And some will say, oh, this party will give more to the pensioners, but that one's better for the executives and this one. Now look, can you honestly say, I don't care who gets in? Because I feel there has been just a little bit of a tendency to see us becoming a little bit partisan. I don't know on what side, I'm not going to say that, but this sort of thing coming up. Could it well be that having seen a time of peace, we are starting to settle our feet down and not realising the lesson is that pagan Rome had to fall and this society is going to fall? Let's make sure that if it does come crashing to the ground, and if we're all out of work tomorrow, that all our hopes don't come crashing with it. Because what would happen if suddenly we all found ourselves out of work tomorrow with no obvious hope of getting another job? Maybe those who are a little bit partisan toward Liberal would hope that Labor would get in because they tend to hand out more money for those who are out of work. But that again would prove that we're in the wrong. Could we honestly say that if this society came crashing down tomorrow, it wouldn't affect our hopes one bit? I think that's a rather searching question to ask, don't you? I've had to ask it to myself. And I've found a couple of times I've had to take two paces backwards because, you know, you hear the comments around the place and you think, oh, that bloke's mad. But the other one's mad too, you know. And this is what we've got to realise. And so the believers here would have come out of a period of peace into a period of war. How did it affect their hopes? It doesn't say here in Revelation, but we know this much, that the truth didn't increase. The truth went progressively backwards until the epitome of error finally became an emperor in the form of Constantine. He called himself a Christian emperor, but he was more pagan than Christian. And we find little of the history of the truth as such. It seems to have declined through those years. And so possibly coming out of a time of peace into a time of war, many of them started to fall with it. But when I say coming into a time of war, what really happened in this period, if you read through that historical section again, was that the Praetorian Guard held sway. That there were quite a number of emperors who got into power simply because they were put there by the military or by the Praetorian Guard. You probably read the rather interesting little story in there about the time when the emperorship was put up to the highest bidder. And was it Julianus and Sulpicianus, I think were the two names from memory, but be that as it may, Sulpicianus and Didius Julianus bid for the position. And it was given to the highest bidder. Unfortunately, the fellow who eventually won only reigned, I think, for 66 days. And so it cost him a lot of money for the remaining 66 days of his life. But what was happening was that the law was being administered by a militant group of soldiers who were dictating the terms. And so militancy became the order of the day, and greed was the thing which determined who was going to rule Rome. This is that period that we're looking at, the period of the Red Horse. If you happen to have it open on page 68 of the notes, you can glance through that as I'm talking there, and you'll see a very similar situation to what we see developing today. Greed is motivating people. It's always motivated people, of course, but you've got a militant group of people who are greedy. And I'm not just talking about the trade unions either, because militancy and greed has to be on the other side of things too. But perhaps there is a bit of a counterpart here, because here is your Praetorian Guard becoming militant and putting the position up to the one who's going to give them the most. And we say it's terrible. Yes, but it rubs off on us too. We say, look, we won't have a bar of this militancy, but, you know, if they get us a few more dollars a week, I'm not going to say no. Mind you, I wouldn't join them, but, you know, secretly I wouldn't mind a little bit more. Well, who would it? Because prices are going up and things are getting dearer and we all seem to need money to spend. But we've got to make sure that we're standing well apart from that. And that when this whole society does blow up, that we don't find we've got our interest so much in the field of money or whatever it might be, that our own hopes are affected. And I would think that here in this period, that many of the true believers were put to the test as this time came on. You cannot serve God and mammon. They declined in their proclamation of the truth. A new period came in and the decline went on. It showed to the believers, for those who could see properly, that many of those who were preaching the truth by word, when it really came to the test, they declined, and the truth, of course, declined with it. So let's make tonight a searching night where we ask ourselves, are we really making the most of this time of peace, the first seal? And are we really quite sure that if a time of war erupts in our own society here, and it could well do in some form or other, that as that society comes crashing to the ground prior to the return of Christ, that our hopes don't come crashing down with it? We come then to the third seal, which was a time of mourning. The third seal saw a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. A time of mourning. The time of mourning, you notice there, was associated very largely with a period of inflation. Verse 6 speaks about the voice in the midst of the four beasts saying, a measure of wheat for a penny and three measures of barley for a penny. According to historical facts, a peck of wheat cost half a denarius at the beginning of the second century, and towards the end of the third, it cost 100 denarii. So it had gone up by 200 times, but 40 years later, it cost 10,000 denarii. It had gone up 10,000 times too. That's 20,000 times. That's an incredible rate of inflation. 20,000 times, isn't it? That's how much the cost of wheat had gone up. It was certainly a period of mourning. People were depressed. They didn't know how they were going to make ends meet. So what did they do? They looked to God. Oh no. Oh no. They said, how can we get some more money? Try and get a bit more overtime out of the boss. Perhaps I get a second job, send some more people in the family out to work. All of these sort of things. And that's going on in the very society in which we live. And it's going on in our own little personal society. We aren't prepared to trust God. We tend to look at somebody else, perhaps in the ecclesia, and say, they've got more than we have. I've got to have the same amount as them. Look, we've got to learn to settle for a level of satisfactory living in which we can serve the truth acceptably. It is fallacious to think that we're going to serve the truth better if we've got more money. There would be very, very few circumstances where we could justify such a thing as this. The fact of the matter is we are living in a period of inflation. It's a period of mourning. Are we mourning? We should be following the example of what the Lord said in Luke chapter 21. Let's look back at those words again. They're very well-known words, but this is the message for today. In Luke chapter 21 and verse 25, there shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars, and upon the earth distress of nations with no way of escape, the sea and the waves roaring. They've been roaring all last week and they're roaring this week. We've got a bit of a break tonight, I believe, because one of them's got a cold or the flu, and we'll be roaring again on Thursday night. But they're roaring all sorts of nonsense. They're all disturbed and they're making everybody else disturbed. men's hearts failing them for fear, for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. When these things begin to come to pass, look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. The period of mourning for the world has to be a period of rejoicing for us. Not rejoicing in the fact that the world is mourning, but rejoicing in the fact that it is a sign of the imminent fall of the empire. The Roman Empire in the days of the apostles and the apocalypse, and of course the Gentile world of today. So what have we got to do? We don't worry about inflation. God will look after us if we labour diligently. We serve our earthly master well. We serve him well. He will provide for our needs. Be thankful for what we've got and press on with the work of the truth. Thankfulness is something which is unknown in society today. Let's make sure, brethren and sisters, it is not something which is unknown in our society, in our ecclesial society. And so how did the brethren and sisters how did they fear in that period when the rest of the empire was mourning? Well, the apocalypse doesn't tell us exactly, but history shows us that there was a steady decline in the truth. All we can assume is that when the empire was suffering in times of war, then the ecclesia suffered with it. When the empire was mourning, the ecclesia mourned with it, because unfortunately they didn't see themselves as being sufficiently separated from that environment in which they lived. And that then brings us to the fourth of the four seals, these four being a group, because each one is introduced by one of the living ones, by one of the beasts, and also is associated with one of the horses. The four horses go through the first four seals, answering to the four phases of the decline of the situation in the Roman Empire, from a time of peace to a time of war, from a time of war to a time of mourning, and from a time of mourning to a time of death. So that the fourth seal and the fourth horse presents to us that chlorotic horse. That was a good word. You'll find it in the notes somewhere too. I got that one from Brother Thomas. It's actually, like all of Brother Thomas's words, extremely accurate. When you look at it, you usually can't find a better word to use. The word chlorotic, of course, comes from the idea of chloros, chloroform, chlorophyll, that idea of that a greenish sort of colour. And it's the word which has been translated pale here in the Authorised Version. You know, it says there the fourth beast was a pale horse. The fourth horse was a pale horse in verse 8. The word is chloros. It was chlorotic in colour. And that means it had this sickly green colour, which, according to Brother Thomas, it was the colour which was associated with death. And that, of course, would seem quite fitting, because the name of the one that sat on him was death, and Hades followed with him. So we come now to the period when the empire was about to fall. It represents an empire which is completely corrupt and dying. And not only that, but it's filled with savage men, because we find them going about, and power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth to kill with the sword, and with hunger, and with death, and with the beasts of the earth. What lesson perhaps comes to us out of this? First seal suggests a time of peace. Let us make the most of our opportunities. The second seal suggests a time of war. Let us be prepared for such situations. The third one is a time of sorrow and of inflation. Now this fourth one shows the empire about to die. It appears that many of the original ecclesia were dying with that empire. But perhaps we could take the lesson from these violent men. Now, violence is certainly a part of our age today. Let's say, in short, that what I'm going to suggest is that, to coin a figure of speech, we do not play them at their own game. Now, I'm not suggesting that we're going to go out to the world and we're going to fight with the world. But it does seem that one of the lessons we learn from the scriptures is this, that as much as we stand apart from society, it tends to rub off on us to some extent. We find that We find that when America has its Watergate, Australia has a Watergate, maybe the Ecclesia has a Watergate. When you see party splits in various parts of the world in politics, very often the Ecclesia has these things. I don't know how this exactly comes about, whether inadvertently we sometimes get caught up with the spirit of things. What I'm suggesting is we're living in a violent age where the niceties of life have gone, manners are a thing of the past, pleasantries are done away with because people are out to stand up for their rights. Let's be very conscious of this, because we might easily find it coming into our ecclesial situation. We might easily find ourselves in a political situation in the next few months where there is going to be very strong militancy on the part of working groups, and equally strong opposition on the part of what could be a government, for example. And whatever the case, there's going to be two factions in society. And that's been promised us, hasn't it? We've been told that's going to happen. Now, the next thing would be to see this come into an ecclesia, where we start to see two groups in an ecclesia. And by the two groups, I mean sort of the them and the us. I suppose the logical division is to make it the rulers and the ruled. That doesn't exist in an ecclesia, but sometimes people create such positions in their own mind. And so maybe we feel that we've got the AB up there as rulers. Please excuse me for saying this, because I don't believe this one little bit, but sometimes people may see that as being a ruling group, so maybe they feel we've got to get another group to oppose the AB. I'm not just theorising or philosophising here. I believe this sort of thing can very readily happen. It does happen. And we don't know why it's happened. We haven't done it consciously, but part of the spirit of the age is, we've got to have democracy. We've all got to have a say. Well, sure, in ecclesial life, everyone's got the opportunity. But I'd hate to see the spirit of the age rub off on us. And maybe the lesson of this fourth seal is that in an empire which was about to die, they still had these violent men going around, and violence being the spirit of the age. Now, let us be old-fashioned, brethren and sisters, and stick to the niceties of life, if we can use that word. It's a word I learnt from Brother Cahoon, who has always maintained these principles, that we must have time for the pleasantries of life, and he didn't mean by that playing around, but have time to talk to each other about the truth, about each other, and not just get into situations where we treat each other as just names on a bit of paper or numbers or something like that. The harshness of this age can easily drive it out of us. You may say, well, I don't see that written there under the fourth horse. Well, it's not written there under the fourth horse, but the fact is that that was the situation of the age. That was the end of the empire, the end of the pagan empire coming up. The empire continued on for another 100 years or so, and could it well be a situation which we're going to see? Well, I think that all of those lessons come to me out of those four horses. I could be wrong in taking some of those lessons out, but even if I'm wrong, I don't think I've lost anything by it, because I've tried to see something there. I think it's a valid thing which I've seen, but I'm not suggesting by any means that it's the only thing to see there. I've read through the papers which you did. I left them down the back, by the way. Some of you picked them up on the way in, and there were quite a few very good comments there. If I might pass a general criticism, I would have thought that perhaps some of the comments were just a little bit too general. Again, to come back to an illustration that I gave last time, sometimes when you ask your children, what should we do to please God? And they have a standard answer, which is, have faith. What should we do to do something else? And they sort of got this idea that, okay, that sounds good. I can't be wrong with that one. If this sounds rather harsh, I don't mean it that way. I got the idea that some of the answers were just so general that, you really didn't know what this specific exhortation was. You thought, I'll put down three lines of something like this, which, well, it's got to be right, whichever way they like to read it. I don't know. That was an impression I got with some of the papers, because I think it was a hard test to just throw this section at people and say, right, what do you get out of it? Particularly a group of people who've been used to sitting there for 12 months and not having to think. Again, excuse me for being harsh, but that's the way it has been, isn't it? That you could sit there and you don't. You just wait for someone to suggest the exhortation, you say, yeah, that sounds all right to me. But when someone says, now you think it up, the whole body sort of goes into a little bit of a convulsion. All right, well, If you feel I've been unfair in saying those things, please pass it off and say, well, that was his opinion. He's wrong. He's completely wrong as far as I'm concerned. I hope I am. But if you think, well, you know, he really did see through my answer, well, I didn't know who you were. I didn't recognise one of them. I didn't try to recognise them. So you just go quietly away and make sure that that you do make amends. All right. Now we're on to the fifth and the sixth seals, which bring this to a climax. Now, I've suggested that the first four seals are a sort of a group in themselves. They're a group in themselves because they look at these four horses, and the four horses represent four phases of the Roman Empire, bringing us up to this end of the pagan Roman period. But now when we come to the fifth seal, we're not looking at the empire, we are now looking at that group which we tried to see implied in those previous four seals. We're now looking at the ecclesia. And so when we come to this this fifth seal, we find in verses 9 to 11 that it says, when he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar, now no longer horses, no longer the beasts opening seals, or rather introducing them, I should say. The Lord, of course, opens them. But he saw under the altar the souls of them who had been slain on account of the word of God and on account of the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, until when, O thou who art the despot holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood upon them who dwell upon the earth? And to them each were given white robes, and it was answered to them that they should repose yet a short time, while both their fellow servants and their brethren should be filled up, who are about to be killed even as they. That was, of course, Brother Thomas's translation taken from the notes. So, whilst the truth was declining, there was still a remnant. And this again seems to be the pattern in all ages, that Yahweh always reserves a remnant, and he intervenes before that remnant is entirely cast off, or cut off, should I say. And so, here at the end of the pagan Roman Empire, God is about to raise up a man who in a sense is going to be their saviour, but in another sense, of course, is going to lay the foundation for something even worse. But in the short term, Constantine was going to be, in a sense, a saviour. He was going to act. He was going to pour out God's judgments on pagan Rome. He was going to be like Nebuchadnezzar, the representative of Yahweh, in a sense. He was going to be like the Medes and Persians. It could be said of Cyrus that he was Yahweh's anointed. These men can be used by God, and they can even be called things like Yahweh's anointed, the hammer of Yahweh. The Medes and Persians were styled the saints in Isaiah chapter 13. And so when a man like Constantine stands up and he does a work which is parallel in a sense to the work that Christ will do when he comes, well, it's quite fitting that Constantine could be figured in a sense as being a type of Christ. However, that's the work of the sixth seal. I'm jumping ahead just a little bit. What I'm trying to say is, though, there were a remnant who were still there. And we look at this remnant when we come to this fifth seal, the group who were styled the souls under the altar. There is a very, very telling comment on page 76 of the notes which speaks about the setting, the historical setting in this time period. You see, we're looking at a time period around about AD 303 to 311. Constantine turns up at 312. So we're getting right to the end now of this pagan empire. And if you come down, oh, we might as well start at the beginning. I was going to start about five lines down, but let's start at the beginning of page 76. In the early part of the reign of Diocletian, the followers of Christ had quietly flourished, whilst the emperor devoted his attention to the reorganization of the establishment and the containing of the barbarian hordes along the frontiers. Ever since the reign of Nero, Christians had endured sporadic persecution, but in spite of this, congregations throughout the empire had held their ground numerically and had even made some converts among Rome's influential families. The period of comparative peace, however, was disastrous for the believers. That was the point I was trying to make earlier under that first and second seal period. Eusebius, he's an ecclesiastical historian, who was contemporary with what he describes, says, through too much liberty, the Christians grew negligent and slothful,
envying and reproaching one another, waging as it were civil war among themselves. And the ecclesiastical historian Milner writes, "The era of its, that is Christianity's, actual declension must be dated in the Pacific, in the peaceful part of Diocletian's reign." I would like each one of us to think very, very seriously about that first statement in particular. Through too much liberty, have we got liberty today? We've got massive liberty today. The Christians grew negligent. Can we say we're growing negligent? And slothful, envying one another, and reproaching one another, waging as it were civil war among themselves. Now that's a statement I reckon we've got to think about. I'm not trying to say that that situation exists, but I'm saying that the potential for that situation to exist is certainly in the world today. It's certainly there, and I feel that we've got to give due attention to make sure that as a result of a period when we've got more liberty than the believers have ever had, more liberty than they've ever had, that the consequences don't turn up today of being negligent, slothful, and spending our time looking around and seeing what our brothers and sisters have got and wishing that we had it as well. That was a comment which I thought was worth noting there. That was then the situation. There's a few other interesting comments there in that historical setting which I'm not going to read through, but if you've already read it, well, you know it. If you haven't, we'll read it a little later on. But it was a period, therefore, of persecution for the believers. So coming back then to what the scripture says, it describes these people as being souls under the altar. Underneath the altar, there were the souls of them who had been slain on account of the testimony. Now this to me seems to be the answer to all of the problems of the previous seals. If people had succumbed to the time of peace, and when the empire started to collapse, their hopes were collapsing with it. When the empire mourned, they mourned. When the empire died, they died. The problem was that they didn't